You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Monday, 28 July. The First World War started today in 1914. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Nick Kunze, Sanlam Private Wealth. We had the AVI update. We had Hyprop exit the Mass PLC offer. But the biggest story perhaps going to be FOMC, MPC, US unemployment. Lots happening this week. Viv Govender, Rand Swiss, Netflix. Good looking numbers. But is there value in the stock as they have no real leverage? Viv is skeptical. Chris Kutsia from FinFix, the 50-30 rule to manage your budget and build an emergency fund. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, Transnet bailouts, government bends with 94.8 billion rand more in guarantees that will ensure all the group's debt repayments are covered for the next 5 years and mitigate the risk of credit downgrades on existing debt. Business day, the US and EU strike a trade pact to avert high tariffs. Baseline 15% tariff will be seen by many in Europe as a poor outcome, considering it was 30, but 15 is a lot. Morning markets, the US was green on Friday, S&P up 0.4%, the Nasdaq a quarter of a percent higher. The East is mostly green. We've got Sydney up 0.3%, Tokyo is the red, off 0.75%, Hong Kong up 0.3%, and Tencent 0.75% higher. Commodities, all red. Gold futures, 3,394. Brent, 68.68. Platinum, 1,401. Palladium, 1,281. The Rand is 17.75. Bitcoin, 119,300. And top 40 opening call, 375 points to the green, 0.4% higher.
MoneyWeb now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Fitting now with Nick Kunze, Sanlam Private Wealth. Nick, appreciate the early morning. Before we get to the craziness of the week ahead, we chatted last week on the Hyprop Mass PLC. So we said then it looked a little bit cheeky. They've now pulled the offer. I suppose it was a little bit cheeky, and they said, "Nap, thanks, we're not going to play anymore."
Yeah, morning, Simon. Morning to the listeners. Yeah, I think it was a little bit opportunistic, to say the least. I think the Hyprop maybe sniffed a little bit of a sort of dissent in the boardroom between what was happening at Mass and what their that Prime Capital, who owns a 50% of issued share on the other side. So maybe saw a little bit of discontent in the C-suite and thought an opportunity to make a cheeky bid. But, I mean, we were advising shareholders, not do anything. And yeah. Sure enough, 5 days, 4 days later.
Yeah, didn't last long at all. The AVI update, I mean, what AVI is well known for, and we can see it in this type, they hold on to margins regardless. And that has served them well, I suppose. But, I mean, we've seen, for example, strong turnaround at Tiger Brands from an investor perspective. You've done a lot better there. Is AVI one that you sort of keep an eye on, that you think is worth putting into a portfolio?
Simon, it's quite a unique share. Like, I don't know what sector you kind of, is it consumer discretionary? Where do you put it as retail? I think it's a very, very good asset. And to your point, they held on to their margins. The operating profit was up almost 8%. But just a note, their margin expansion largely from that beverage gross margin recovery and their tight cost controls. They're very good at that. And that was despite, I think, a 42 million restructuring cost. So, kudos to the management. But I think it is very much a bet on SA if SA gets right, and the SA consumer, and we've seen the SA Inc. Stocks under pressure recently. I do think this is one, if you like the South African story and you want exposure to the JSE, I think this is one of these ones you can have, and it's a long history of a very well run business.
The week ahead, lots happening. We've got FOMC, we've got MPC, we've got Bank of Japan, we've got rates all over the place. I mean, I suppose let's start home. Surely the MPC needs to cut on Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, it's a no-brainer. I mean, we're going to get maybe, 25 bips. I mean, we could be, I would argue you could do 50 bips. You could probably do 100 basis points, so the Rand might even strengthen. such as the crying out for some sort of action from the Reserve Bank, which I have to say is starting to look a little bit more like a policy error, not just hawkish. I mean, they're the last one standing, really. So, yeah, 25 basis points in the bag. You know, let's hope sanity prevails and maybe we get 50.
Yeah, but
the rest of the marketplace. Sorry, Simon. Carol. Yeah,
no, you tweeted that during the week when inflation came out last week. It is starting to look like black policy errors. FOMC, do they change? Does Jerome Powell hold the line?
Yeah, he does. I think he does more than most. I mean, he's been more than critical of the fact of Fed independence and his rate dependence and all the rest of it. What I do think is interesting is there's starting to become a little more of dissenters on that sort of Federal Reserve board, which is quite rare. You know, that kind of internal division doesn't often happen, and I think Mark's starting to pay attention to him. So, yeah, I think he holds pat this time round, but the pressure's certainly mounting if they get that they'll be cutting going into the year.
And then U.S. unemployment, and I mean, you and I have chatted a lot around this. It's expected to tick up slightly to 4.2. Unemployment in America has just been immensely strong.
Yeah, any measurement of economic situations, you look at what they are doing over there. They have full employment, and inflation and growth is, as we said, is a little bit on the upper side. It's what you want to look at is you want to see maybe hourly earnings coming in a little bit, taking that pressure off inflation. But for now, you know, you look at the earnings season that's kicked off so strongly. You look at the numbers. You know, the U.S. is this remarkable engine. You know, don't bet against it. And I think we'll get another decent set. Though it is quite a bit of waiting on this number, because as we start getting into the second half of the year, this market is looking a little bit full on the U.S. side.
Yeah, it absolutely is. The valuation's absolutely there. We'll leave it there. Nick Kunze, Sanlam Private Wealth. Always appreciate the early morning time. Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for three decades.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Viv Govender, Rand Swiss. Viv, appreciate the time. Netflix second quarter results for financial year 2025. Revenue was, up 16% year on year. Diluted earnings per share up 47%. Operating margin sitting at 34.1%. Everyone's calling this a strong Q2. They're calling it a knockout. What's your take on the Netflix numbers and the broader picture?
I mean, it's always about the pricing. I mean, the market this year's date has basically rewarded Netflix by over a third. So it's up like 34% for the year, even after this most recent fall. So the market is expecting quite good news, and it's got it. My only question with Netflix and these entertainment franchises has always been, I mean, I remember back in the day, like, you know, like Star Wars came out, and apparently 1% of the total revenue of Star Wars came from the movies. And that is the thing here with Netflix, is that, you know, Disney has the ability to monetize its stuff in ways that, you know, Netflix can't. You know, Julius, Moana is going to be earning their money 100 years from now, and kids are still buying those little, like, outfits and whatnot.
Yeah.
You think of, like, Cinderella and stuff. It's still earning money nowadays. Same thing with Amazon. It's basically a add-on to something that makes them even more money elsewhere. Netflix, you know, as a pure entertainment play, look, they've managed to execute things on a far better level than Disney. Disney has been self-destructive with own goals with things like Snow White and, you know, a couple other things that they've done, you know, the Buzz Lightyear movie and so on. And even Star Wars, they've kind of like damaged a franchise. But the thing with them is that a hit like Stranger Things is worth a lot more to a Disney than it is to a Netflix. Because Disney will make Stranger Things, pay them for the subscription, and then get kids to ride the Stranger Things ride in like Disney World and Disney Parks or whatever around the world, and then go and buy the Stranger Things lunchboxes that are going to be everywhere, as well as the Stranger Things figurines. You know what I mean? And then team up with Lego and make a Stranger Things Lego set. That is what Disney can do.
It's that ability to leverage. And Netflix, I mean, they've got games in their app. I'm not a current subscriber to Netflix, so I don't know what those games are. But that's also part of the trick with it is, you know, I remember when we first started getting streaming, I signed up for everybody. And now I have only one at a time. And when I'm tired of it, I, you know, close one, subscribe to the next one. It's also just a click away. And it means they're constantly on that flywheel of having to make content.
My point of view, the only thing that I have to have basically is, you know, the sports one, which is obviously going to be not Netflix, and the kids one, which is going to be Disney. Because, you know, and they'll watch the same thing 1,000 times, but it's a safeguard, and we can put them in and just be safe with, you know what I mean? Which I don't mind at all. So, but the thing with Netflix is, look, I mean, the thing that saved them is that they have been better at curating what they're creating. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yes, there's a whole thing about like the junk that they create and whatnot. But look at what Disney has done to the Star Wars franchise. Mm-hmm. With one hit and like a bunch. I mean, Andor is good and I've watched a couple of things myself, but a lot of stuff isn't just junk. And they kind of damage that franchise, you know, maybe fatally. But like I said, it's something that they can revamp in a year's time or 10 years' time. And I don't think you're going to be seeing the same kind of, you know, Squid Games, you know, renewal coming about in 10 years' time and having the same cultural impact that I think Star Wars has had for the last literally 40 years.
Is there also then, because I take your point around Disney, and Disney Plus, as you said, they've had some challenges, some own goals and the like, but Disney as a broader brand has got that leverage impact. Then there's also YouTube. And I saw a stat the other day, which on the TV, so not on our mobile devices and our laptops, on the TV in the US, YouTube is the most watched product. And it's how I watch YouTube. And maybe if you're looking for streaming, you're better off there because they don't pay for that. And Alphabet's perhaps not as expensive, although got maybe its own challenges in the AI space.
Look, I mean, Alphabet, if you look at it, about half of Alphabet's money and maybe 100% of its profitability comes from that little search bar. That doesn't mean, however, that the rest of that business is worth nothing. YouTube, like I said, more views than Netflix and a better business model. Netflix has to put money down to get, you know, Dave Chappelle down or get John Mulaney down, you know, to do a series that doesn't do that great. But Mr. Beast does his own thing. Does his own risk and whatnot. If one day Mr. Beast turns out to be like, you know, canceled or just basically runs out of fashion, YouTube will just basically not have to pay him anymore. It'll pay after he creates the product. So it's a much better business, you know, thing. The one thing I do have a question about, like going forward, is like, you know, with AI coming about, I do think that the people that own the IP, I mean, maybe in the future, you may not want to, you know, just go to the shop and like, you know, order a screamer and watch the latest Star Wars movie, mm-hmm. but you might want to watch a Star Wars movie with Superman in there, or with, you know, Buzz Lightyear or the Avengers in there. And then you are going to need the IP licensing. And I think that licensing has become a lot more valuable in the future where you can create, you know, with prompts or whatever. I'm, of course, talking, you know, a few years in the future.
Yeah.
But I think that's something that Netflix doesn't have quite the brand around. Yes, they've had Stranger Things, but can you name, besides Stranger Things and Squid Games, a Netflix brand?
I mean, I can, but it's the Orange is the New Black, and that's, what, 10, 15 years old.
Yeah, I mean, there's not exactly something where you're going to be, you know, creating like, you know, fan fiction around it. Yeah, but yeah, exactly. But Disney, there's so many you can go for ages. I mean, Pooh, the Avengers, you know, Star Wars, Buzz Lightyear, that kind of stuff. There's so many things that's going to be like possible to be in the future. I think that's valuable. YouTube, on the other hand, you know, if people become to a point where it's democratized creation, I think that is the one thing that suits YouTube beyond anybody else.
A last question, back to Netflix, they stopped reporting subscriber numbers and they told the market they were going to do this. And their argument that they're going to be focusing on growth and other drivers and subscriber numbers are no longer as important. And I have to say, I'm like, I mean, I hear what they're saying, but the lack of subscriber numbers makes me at best scratch my head.
Yeah, look, I mean, they're trying a lot of stuff at the moment. The unfortunate thing is if you're going to be selling a fixed price thing, how could you actually basically require some kind of, you know, expansion of the market.
Yeah.
You know, eventually Apple had to have the App Store because, quite frankly, there's only so many iPhones that can be sold in the world. Once you had your iPhone and maybe your iPad, you really don't need much more than that. Mm-hmm. And once you have your subscription to Netflix, you're not going to be able to monetize it beyond that. And that's, again, the advantage that Disney has. Disney can make you basically spend tens of thousands of dollars basically on Moana if you basically get addicted to it, or rather your kids get addicted to it. You know what I mean? With rides and all the kind of thing that comes along with it. You can't do that with Netflix. They have to figure something about that. 100% of the revenue basically comes from subscription services. They are trying to do things like, for instance, you know, advertising and that going forward. But I don't know what the model is going to be once they've kind of saturated themselves. And once they start hitting the people like you who don't want to be just paying for a subscription, forgetting about it, but will rather like, you know, cycle through the various subscriptions out there.
Yeah. And that's their challenge. And the stock, 51 PE. We leave it there. Viv Govender, Rand Swiss, always appreciate the insights. And that's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Do you hold the streaming stock? Viv makes some good points there. Their inability to leverage. Make no mistake, they're a great business, but they don't have that leverage perhaps that Disney does. They also don't have that sort of distribution that YouTube does have. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. Let your money weather the storms with Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in the Stanlib Global Select Fund, a diversified all-weather equity portfolio sub-managed by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Chris Cousier. He's CEO of FinFix. Chris, appreciate the time today. Two perhaps slightly contradictory, but pieces of data, the 2025 Economic Insights by Nedbank, personal saving rates negative 1.2%. On the flip side, we've seen some slightly better consumer spending data. And of course, maybe that spending is on credit. But I mean, the short answer is it is maybe easier to be a South African consumer than it was a year ago, but it is still tough.
Yeah, Simon, I can agree with you there. I don't think the average consumer would agree with us necessarily, but the stats speak a different story.
In a recent article you're writing, you're talking about trying to sort of break the cycle being typically an over-debted consumer, the 50-30-20 rule as a budgeting tool. Talk to me around the 50-30-20.
So the 50-30-20 rule is a guideline for consumers to budget. When we deal with consumers in our practice, we always try and give them a few options regarding budgeting, and these are one of the options we put forward. So what the 50-30-20 rule would entail is 50% would go for consumers' needs. This would include essential expenses like housing, groceries, transportation, utilities, and insurance, and then 30% for wants. You know, that would be for travel, hobbies, dining out, and then a 20% allocation for savings and debt repayments above the minimum.
And you made the point there, because that's a nice, clear process that someone can follow. Someone out there is thinking, yo, the 20% number, as an example, almost impossible. It might feel daunting, but I mean, start somewhere, I suppose, is the mantra, really.
Yeah, we'd always start with assessing where you're at currently. So, you know, how much are you spending on needs versus wants, and how much are you putting away for savings? And some consumers might find that they're already close to a 50-30-20 breakdown. Consumers who aren't can work towards this goal.
The other strong point, I suppose, is that it's about consistency. It's also about tracking, and that's hugely important. And tracking is easier these days with a lot of tools, but that's hugely important.
Yeah, if you don't keep track of your expenses, you won't be able to budget. You won't know what you're spending your money on, and you won't be able to strive for any savings or investment goals.
You also spoke around the 30% to the wants. I mean, not a sort of free for all. I mean, still be, I don't know, be conscious on those wants and make them real and material, perhaps, rather than just sort of flip-flopping around and spending the money willy-nilly.
Yeah. It won't be wise to spend, you know, all your money on once if you haven't set up an emergency fund and your finances aren't stable. You know, this 50-30-20 rule is, you know, the best circumstance you could wish for. Mm-hmm. But you can only spend like this if you've done your homework and everything's stable.
You mentioned emergency fund there. I've chatted around that before on the show. That, I imagine, is probably the first step, is that, I mean, even if you've perhaps got some debt, is to build that emergency fund, because it just gives you, it gives you that wiggle room for when something does go wrong, and it will at some point.
Yeah, the emergency fund will also protect you and keep you from making more unnecessary debt. Mm-hmm. So it is crucial for consumers to keep that in mind.
What sort of, I mean, is there an ideal number that emergency fund should be? Because I hear all sorts of numbers floated around. What do you and your team consider a good emergency fund number?
The best emergency fund would be a fund where you have at least 6 months of your income saved. Mm-hmm. That's not possible for consumers, you know, in the short term, but that's something to work towards. At the bare minimum, a consumer should have at least 1 month of their income saved. That will at least protect you from spending shocks like a flat tire or something like that. In the case of a 6 month emergency fund, that would protect you in case of loss of income. If you get retrenched or have to take maternity leave, then you'll have enough time to seek a new job, for instance.
I like that way of looking at it, where there's going to be different types of emergencies, and understand that where you are and that and how many months you've got is going to depend on sort of which ones you can easily absorb. And the point is ultimately to be absorb them all. We'll leave it there. It's Chris Cousier, CEO, FinFix. Appreciate the time. That's it for today. We're chatting with Keith McLachlan on Friday. We were talking smaller mid-caps. We've got the All Share It Records. My question to him was, so how's smaller mid doing? The answer is lots of it's doing well. But SA Inc., if we get to 2-3% GDP, then it really fires. We asked how your small and mid-cap stocks are doing. Half said great, loving them. A quarter each said struggling, or only large caps for you. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Peregrine Mid-Year Review.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now. On the money.